the tour, we should like to ask you about your early life, just where you were born and something about your early experience before you came to Washington Lee.
Well, I was born in Sullivan County, Tennessee. It's about 16 miles from Bristol, Tennessee. And I was there until I was about 14, 15 years old. I finished the fifth grade. I finished the fifth grade in this school that I attended, and that was all the school there was. There wasn't any more for me to go to. So I worked that winter, that year, driving a four-horse team, hauling lumber from the area where we lived to the station at Piney Flats, Tennessee. And I drove four horses all winter long, hauling lumber. The next year, my father and mother moved to Bristol, Tennessee, so we could go to school. There were six children in the family, and they wanted us to get more schooling than I was able to get where we lived. So we moved to Bristol, Tennessee, and I attended school there until I finished high school. I went in, I took the two halves of the sixth grade were in the same room, and so I took both the A and B section and finished the sixth grade in one term. The next year I took the seventh and eighth grade, were in the same room, and I took both of them to kind of catch up. So I finished the high school, however, and then the question was about going to college. I had thought I was going to the University of Tennessee because I didn't think I could afford Washington Lee as it was that time, because tuition was $85 a year, and I didn't have that much money to spare. So at any rate, during the summer, the principal of our school, William A. Anderson II, the nephew of William A. Anderson, who was well known in Lexington and was Attorney General at one time in the state of Virginia, Mr. Anderson went to visit his uncle in Lexington, and while he was here, he saw Dr. George H. Denny, who was president of Washington Lee, and they must have got in conversation about possible students, and Dr. Denny told Mr. Anderson to tell me to come on up to Washington Lee, and he'd see that I got along all right here. What he meant by that, I think, that he would see that I got some financial aid or something of the sort. But at any rate, I decided to come to Washington and Lee then, although I had already reserved a room at the University of Tennessee. I came here in 1911 to Dr. Denny, who was president, and while he had told me he'd look after me, he left Washington and Lee in at the end of the year. He went to the University of Alabama as president. And we know that he started the big football teams down there that's still rolling. Dr. Denny was much interested in football, so that he had, even the year I came in, we had several good football players came into to the school, and we had a very good record of football in those days when our teams could play on even keel with BPI and University of Virginia and North Carolina and North Carolina State, teams like that. But at any rate, I came to Lexington with a friend of mine from Bristol. We'd been in, graduated together, and he came along with me to Lexington. We roomed together, slept in the same bed for 4 years at a boarding house where we had our room and took our meals.
What boarding house was this?
This is George Deaver's boarding house, which was across the street from the old hospital, the Stonewall Jackson House. Well, I did get some financial aid from home for 2 years, and after that I had to go on my own because there were other children coming along, and my father was in the postal service and got a very modest salary so that he couldn't help me any after my second year. But I continued, and a very surprising thing happened to me. I came back to college my junior year, and I had $75 to see me through the year. And when I got to my room, I found a note from Dr. Easter, who was head of the French department, saying that he'd like to see me as soon as I could get out to his house on Jefferson Street. So I went out to see Dr. Easter and wondered what in the world he wanted to see me about. He told me that Dean Campbell was ill and that he'd been asked to serve as dean of the college that year, and he wanted me to take a section of elementary French to teach. And that, of course, was a big surprise and meant a lot to me financially because it paid $250 for teaching me a section for a year. And so, but at any rate, that helped me meet my expenses. Well, I didn't take much part in athletics, although in the class games like football and basketball, I did participate. And actually, the senior year, I was captain of the 1915 basketball team on the campus, and we won the championship of the school with the four academic classes and the two law classes. So we, I rode on the boat crew for 2 years, actually 3 years, because I, first year I was on the second crew, and I rode on the first crew 2 years, and we won 1 year and we lost 1 year. That puts us, I suppose it's fair enough to break even. And a rather odd thing also is that Dr. Franklin Riley came in my senior year. I had a class with him in history, Greek and Roman history. Then the next year, when I was here to get my master's degree, Dr. Riley asked me to teach the course in, which I had had the year before, which shows you the kind of standards they had back in those days. So I was teaching two sections of French and one section of history, which meant that I was comfortably fixed as far as eating and paying my room and board concerned. So I did have that experience.
Who was the fellow that roomed with you?
Samuel G. Keller from Bristol, Tennessee. His father ran a saloon. He was a saloon keeper, as they said. But I recall particularly the fact that Sam's father cautioned him about drinking. That he was a saloon keeper, but he knew the evils of drink, and so his son Sam never took a drink at Washington Lee, as far as I know. We got along without any liquor in our room. Well, of course, the teachers I had that year, revealing, I think, the fact that I had English under a man who was here, Amos Lee Harold, was working for his master's degree, and he taught a section of freshman English. Mr. Dolly taught the elementary French course. He was in the law school. He had worked with Dr. Easter and Randolph Bacon before he came to Washington and Lee. So, and had mathematics under a man by the name of Hannes, Herbert Hannes, who was a law student and also a good basketball player. So I had meth with him, and had history with a man from down in Norfolk. I forgot his name now. I can think of it correctly, maybe. But any rate, four of my classes were with student instructors, and one class I had with Dr. Latney, who was well known in history. And the next year after I had worked with him, he went to Johns Hopkins as dean of the graduate school at Johns Hopkins. But that is something that doesn't happen anymore to Washington Lee. They have a lot of student instructors. You can understand that when you say what I've already said, that tuition was $85 a year, and a good many students had $50 scholarships. A very interesting story involving Captain Dick Smith, who was well known on the campus for many years as the director of, or I guess they call him, graduate manager of athletics. I heard Captain Dick tell this story, which I think may be proper to say here. Captain Dick came here from Fishburne Military Academy over in Waynesboro, and he didn't have any money. He was a good baseball player, and when he went through the line to register, went to the treasurer's office, Mr. John L. Campbell, who was treasurer, said, you don't have enough money. He said, yeah, pay. Captain Dick, he wasn't called Captain then, but we call it that later. He thought he had two scholarships, $50 each. The school gave a $50 scholarship to a student from a high school, a preparatory school, who had the best grades of those who applied to Washington Lee. Well, at any rate, Captain Dick had that scholarship from Fishburne, and he thought he had another one from Dr. Denny himself. So he said, well, Mr. Campbell told him that only one scholarship could be honored. He didn't have two scholarships. So Captain Dick said he'd have to leave school, and he let me start the league, packed up his things, and students gathered around to do something about it because he was a good baseball player, and people took baseball pretty seriously in those days. So the students went up to see Dr. Denny and told him the story, and Dr. Denny sent for Captain Dick to come up and see him, and he did, and told him his story. Dr. Denny said, why didn't you tell me you didn't have any money? Well, he thought he had two scholarships, which would each $50 would put him through as far as tuition is concerned. But, finally, Dr. Denny wrote him out a note for another scholarship so that he was able to stay. So Captain Dick went over on Randolph Street and found a room that he could rent for $5 a month. It had a double bed in it. So he came back up the street and met a student who was looking for a place to room. Captain Dick said, well, you can room with me for $5 a month. That's what he was paying for his room. So this boy said he'd pay $5 a month. So the two of them slept together and spent the year that way. Then he came up to the town again. There was a restaurant where Alvin Dennis' store is now. And he went in to see the proprietor of the restaurant and told him that he would like to do something to earn his meals. And so the man told him, he said, you see the table over there? So that table will seat 8 people. If you get 7 more boys to buy their meal tickets here and eat there, I'll give you your meals. So Captain Dick went out and got the students to take their meals at this restaurant. So that's the way people did back in those days to get along and meet the requirements. But at any rate, I myself was interested in good many things in college. I was very active in the YMCA and was president my senior year of the YMCA, which was pretty active in those days. And I was interested in literary society. I was won a debater's medal in the Graham Lee Literary Society. And I went out in the country and served as superintendent of a Sunday school out of Poplar Hills to pass away my Sunday afternoons. And there were several activities of one sort or another that I took part in. Well, that probably leads me up to the matter of of the ODK. My senior year, I roomed with Carl Fisher, my best friend in college, and we got the idea of, started out with the thought of organizing the student assistants, the student instructors. That was the first idea, and then we changed that to selecting the what we considered to be the leading students into an organization with some faculty members to deal with problems of students on the campus. So we started that in 1914. On December the 3rd, 1914, the public announcement made of the organization, which consisted of 12 students, two faculty members, and the president of the university. Dr. Hayden Lewis Smith was president and of the university. Dr. Easter was my special friend because he'd taken me in as an instructor in French, and Fisher's best friend was Professor Humphreys in engineering. Fisher was in the engineering school, and we had an engineering school in those days. So we had Fisher's favorite professor and my favorite professor and the president of the university, and 12 students. Sad to say now that I'm the only one of the group of 15 still living. I don't know how that happens or why it happened, but that's the way it is. Well, we got ODK started, and two of our alumni were at Johns Hopkins University and doing graduate work, and we encouraged them to talk up ODK at Johns Hopkins, and that's the way they became the beta chapter of Circle, we call them, of ODK. And I was on a debate team against the University of Pittsburgh, and was wearing an ODK key, and the Pittsburgh members of the debating team were curious about that ODK key, and so the result of that was that they organized Circle ODK at University of Pittsburgh, and that's the way the organization got started. And of course, as you know pretty well, it now has more than 180 schools have circles of ODK, which is an amazing thing.
Would you tell us something about the general purpose of ODK?
Well, the purpose of ODK, so we said, was to honor students who exhibited exceptional leadership qualities on the campus, and to for them to undertake to do anything they could to promote the best interests of the students on the campus, and to have faculty members participate so that there would be the best possible relation between students and faculty members on our campus. And I think it has worked to some extent along that line, although it has changed a little, but very little since we started. It's that remarkable. I guess one of the things that I should say with regard to my part was to design the key. group wanted a symbol of some kind to represent the organization. So they asked people to make suggestions. And several suggestions were made as to keys and different forms of some emblems. But I happened to, when I was in philosophy class, Dr. Howard's philosophy class, I took a card out of my pocket and two coins of unequal size and drew the circle and put the letters inside the circle, which is familiar on the campus now. But they passed around the other suggestions on paper, and nobody seemed to like any of them, so I gave this out, and the group, the members of the group, thought that was the thing to do, and so that was adopted as the symbol of ODK, and it hasn't been changed any since. I've remarkable that it should continue to just exactly in the form in which it's originated.
Where is its headquarters?
Headquarters in Louisville, Kentucky, at the University of Kentucky. We have a full-time secretary now. That's just within the past, about a year ago, they decided they had to have a full-time secretary because with 180-some circles to keep track of, it Ben, well, couldn't do that and hold another job. One of the first national secretaries was William Mosley Brown, who did that on the side, so to speak. And Dr. Bishop was secretary for many years, a very fine man in every respect, a splendid man who was executive secretary for many years and did a splendid job, and we're greatly indebted to him for the service which he rendered in that capacity. He's still living and he's retired now from active duty, but he still lives in Cincinnati and is a real good friend of mine. I'm very fond of Bob Bishop.
Could you tell us when you went into the service in the First World War? What time in your career was that?
As I said a while ago, I was active in the YMCA here, and when the First World War came on, I was asked to serve as in some capacity in the YMCA, National YMCA. And I went down to Fort McPherson in Georgia to the officers' training camp, thinking I might go into the camp itself. But I hadn't been there long when I had a call from somebody in Washington. At least the officers at Fort McPherson said I had been called. Somebody wanted to speak to me, and I got on the telephone, and they said they would like for me to go to France to be with the French army if I would be willing to do that. And so I said, yes, I'll do it. And so I went with a group, the first group went over in what they called the Foyer de Soldats. We didn't know what we were going to do when we got over there. Actually, this was when General Pershing arrived in France in July 1917. He marched with a small contingent of American troops on Champs-Élysées and soon discovered that the French morale was lower than people in this country had realized. And so they wanted to do something, and one of the things they did was to ask some Americans who could speak French to go along the front, to be distributed among the French at the front, to counteract the German propaganda, which was to the effect that people were being deceived by their leaders that America was not going to really help in the war, and that what they should do would be to throw down their arms, go home and look after their families, that sort of propaganda. But it was our business to explain to the French why America did not send over a big contingent of soldiers immediately after we declared war, because it took all of our soldiers we had to train the great number of civilians coming into the service. So that was the work of the Foyer de Souda. It was an organization which was, I never took any combat training, but I did, was at the front for a year in this service around the Verdun area. I probably was one of the youngest of the group went over. Most of the people who went were French teachers in the colleges, and I was about the youngest, so they put me up front up at the Verdun area, which was a very interesting place. Of course, you probably are aware of the fact that more people, I suppose, died in that war, in that battle, than in any other battle in history. And the place was just torn to pieces, of course, with the bombing that went on for weeks. The Germans took Verdun during the war, but the French retook it, and I went into the service just as the French had recaptured Verdun. And they were, that was an underground fort, badly battered. One of the things we did was to furnish, had to have a room, something like this, they called it a casemate, with a table and with a phonograph and some books and some writing paper. That was one of the things we did to have, to be able to mingle with the French, and they'd gather around. Of course, they were interested in an American, to find out information about what was going on, what they could expect. So that was a very interesting experience I had there. In Fort Douma, I was in at an artillery camp for 2 weeks, and then go up to Fort Verdun for 2 weeks, because 2 weeks was as long as they thought anybody's health would stay in the underground fort. So that was my experience there. And then after the Americans got into the war, then that answered the question about what America was going to do, and so I went in the American Army as served as interpreter and then translator for the rest of, for another year. Pretty lucky to get out, I suppose, without a scratch.
And then when did you return to Washington Lee here?
I came home in the end of the summer of 1919, and I referred a while ago to William Mosley Brown, who was one of the founders of ODK. Fisher and I invited Brown to join us. He was the third member in the group to start with, and he had taken a position as head of a Central Academy out in Patrick County, Virginia, and he had been offered later the principalship of the high school in Danville, his hometown, and he wanted to take that, and they told him they'd relieve him from his they would relieve him at Central Academy if he'd find a replacement. Well, I arrived in New York, and William was at Columbia University studying that summer, and I got back, and he met me and offered me the job, and I didn't have any job or any money, and I had a wife that I'd married on my way to France. I married on Tuesday night, sailed on Saturday morning, and gone for 2 years. That was quite a honeymoon, I guess. At any rate, I took the job at Central Academy, and at the end, during that year, John Graham, who was a member of our faculty, a very popular member of our faculty, was teaching in French and Spanish, and he decided to go to Princeton to study for his graduate degree, and so Dr. Easter wrote to me and asked if I would come to fill in for John Graham for 2 years. And so I did, and we never been able to get rid of him since.
Then when did you start teaching the courses in the government and politics?
Well, I taught in the French department for 4 years, and then I was doing graduate work in the summer at the University of Chicago, and then I moved over into political science. I had majored in political science as an undergraduate.
Would you tell us something about some of the interesting professors here, one in your department, I guess?
Dr. Easter was a very interesting man. They called him CUNY Easter. He was a very witty, clever, pleasant man to deal with. He had a strange way of grading students by a third or fourth decimal point sometimes. He would, in class, he would grade papers most meticulously, and a student would ask Dr. Easter, how did I come out on that course? He said, well, he just chuckled. Well, he said, you almost passed that. He goes, you almost passed it. Didn't quite, but not quite. But he chuckled, you don't tell it. Well, that was one of his characteristics, but the nicknames we had for our professors then, Sissy Stevens in physics. I had a course with Dr. Stevens, and they called him Sissy Stevens because he was so systematic. You can't imagine how meticulous and systematic he was in his requirements. And had Slouch Houghton, who was in philosophy. He would, only one morning, one of his colleagues did.